For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Let's move along here, get into Daniel chapter 9. This is one of my favorite passages, I think, in the Old Testament. It's the fourth in a series of prophetic visions recorded in Daniel. And this has to do with 70 sevens. Now, in Isaiah, God says, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to anyone else, and I will not share my praise with carved idols. Everything I prophesied has come true, and now I'll prophesy again. I'll tell you the future before it happens. So, God wants us to know when He speaks that this is me talking and that this is for real. It's very important that we distinguish between the concept of faith as something that faith means I choose to believe something because it seems good to me. Whether it's actually true or not, I mean, I don't know, you know, who can be sure, but I choose to believe it. That's one type of faith. That's not biblical faith. In biblical faith, why do we believe something? It's because it's true. We believe it because it's actually real. And that's a reason to believe in something. So when we talk about Jesus Christ, when we talk about the Bible, are we talking about something that we just choose to believe because it's like a religion that we want to be in? Is Christ just like trying the latest aspirin pill to see if that works on my headache or not? Or do we believe these things because they're actually literally real and true? This is what God wants us to see, is that this is not just another school of thought like being a Browns fan instead of a Bengals fan. I mean, that's a choice you make. There's no way to say that you could wonder in that particular case. That's probably a bad example. But really, you know, there's nothing to say that being a fan of one team is better than being a fan of another team. And a lot of people view all religion this way and all spirituality this way. And God says here, that's not good enough. I'm not going to share. I'm God. It's like, there's no one else here but me. And I'll prove that to you by doing something that only God can do. I can tell you the future course of history before it happens. And I think we have one of the more remarkable examples of that in this passage. We're now the Babylonians that captured Daniel and exiled him are gone. They've been taken over by the Persian Empire. And Daniel gets yet another vision. This time an angel comes to him and says, here's what I have to tell you. The section we want to focus on starts in verse 24. Where it says, 70 sevens are decreed for your people, your holy city, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy, or as some translations will read, the most holy place. Probably referring to the temple. There's a list of things that your people, the Jewish people, need to finish their job that God's given them to do. And it involves all these things. Some of these things have definitely not happened yet, even in our day. So this prophecy probably spans clear into the future. But part of it covers past history and part of it future history. The most important part to start here is this. What is a seven? 70 sevens. Some of the translations you read will say 70 weeks. In Hebrew, the word shabua, or the plural shabuim, can be translated weeks. That's their word for week. But it is also the word for seven. And as a matter of fact, the Jews had sevens of days, which was a week, but they also had sevens of years. And we have to determine which is in view here. To do that, the best thing to do is to look at the context that this comes up in. That's the first rule of interpretation. Interpret in light of the context, right? In verse 1, we read that this happened in the first year of Darius, the son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom. Okay, so that dates this basically in around 539 BC, according to that date. If you remember, Daniel was taken into captivity in chapter 1 in 605. So he's now an old man. He was taken as a boy, and now he's in his maybe 60s or 70s probably. The difference between these, already he's been in Babylon 67 years. And it could even be that he would consider this to be 68 or even 69 years, because the way they counted, if there was a part of a year, they would count that as a whole year. And so depending on how you count, he's realizing that they're coming up on 70 years of captivity. And this is why he started to pray to God. And he explains this for us in verse 2. He says, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of the years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. And he's looking, thinking, that's coming right up here. We've been here 67, 68 years already. And so he begins to pray to God, and he studies the scriptures. He's studying in the books. One of the books that he's reading is the book of Jeremiah, written before him, just barely. And he sees a prophecy in Jeremiah that the people of Israel are going to be kicked out of their land and exiled in a foreign country in Babylon. And this passage he's referring to is in Jeremiah 25, 9 to 11. There we read that God speaking, I will summon the peoples of the north and my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, declares the Lord, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants and against all the surrounding nations, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. That's what Daniel has just read, and that's what got him thinking about this. We also read later in back to Daniel 9, down in verse 11, he didn't just read Jeremiah, he was also reading the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, because he says, indeed, all Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, not obeying your voice. So the curse has been poured out on us, along with the oath, which was written in the law of Moses, the servant of God. So it's Jeremiah and Moses, both, that he's reading, getting insight from here. We can also determine what he's reading in Moses. He's got to be reading Leviticus 26 and following, 27 and following, where God warns the people, if in spite of this you still do not listen to me, but continue to be hostile toward me, I will scatter you among the nations and will draw out my sword and pursue you. Your land will be laid waste and your cities will lie in ruins. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate, and you are in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. And so, clear back in the time of Moses, almost 1,000 years earlier than Daniel, God had warned, if you guys turn against me, here's going to be the discipline I'm going to give you. You'll be exiled, and while you're over in the land of your enemies, living there, the land of Israel will enjoy its Sabbath years. Now, Daniel just read this passage, right? Because he said, I was reading in Moses about the curse that we would be sent to a foreign country. And so he's in a foreign country as he reads this and realizes this is what Moses predicted. And it has something to do with the Sabbath years. Now, in the previous chapter, God had explained what Sabbath years are. Namely, every seventh year in Israel, they were supposed to not farm, let the land rest. And that's the Sabbath year, the seventh year, and it's a year of rest for the land. Okay? Today, we understand this is actually good agricultural practice, because by letting the land sit fallow, that gives a chance for nitrogen-fixing plants to enrich the soil, and you don't deplete the soil that way. But it was also a supreme act of faith in God, that you had to save up extra grain and food during the 6 years and then not farm for a seventh year. Well, you didn't get any harvest that year. And so this was not a real popular law in Israel. You can imagine. I mean, this was costing people money, they thought. And it was never really followed very much. And God knew this was going to happen clear back here. And that's why he says, when I exile you to this other country, then all the years that you never observed the Sabbath year on the land, we'll just let the land rest for 70 years in a row. 70 times they must have ignored this law. Now, this is not the only reason they were exiled, okay? This is not even the main reason. I mean, the reason they were exiled, there were things way worse than disobeying the Sabbath law. The human sacrifice they were practicing to the gods Baal and Moloch were a lot more important than this part. But the time period apparently was set by God because of this rule of the Sabbath years, the seven-year rule. This is all put together for us. Yeah, the important point here is that the context that Daniel is studying and realizing this is why God says 70 years that we're going to be under in exile has to do with sevens of years, not sevens of days. Right? Second Chronicles 36, verse 20 and 21 confirms this whole picture and kind of puts it all together for us. There we read that Nebuchadnezzar carried into exile to Babylon the remnant of the people, and they became servants to him and his sons until the kingdom of Persia came into power. The land enjoyed its Sabbath rests all the time of its desolation. It rested until the 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. And that really puts all of these texts together, doesn't it? Right there, Second Chronicles. Nice verse. Well, so we round this all up and we just realize, okay, so Daniel is going through this Bible study and what he's realizing is, you know, we're going to be going back home pretty soon because the land has now, you know, enjoyed 70 years of rest. Those are the Sabbath years. We skipped all those. How many years had they ignored the Sabbath law? 70 times 7, 490 years. So this law was hardly ever followed. Let's go back to Daniel 9. And so there's the context. Now, so what is the angel saying to Daniel? He's saying, okay, you guys blew it for 490 years. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get you 490 more years. All right, let's try this again. And so the 77s are 77s of years. And here's how it breaks down. Verse 25. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. And that may sound a little cryptic or confusing. It's actually not. Just look at the connecting words. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, comes, there will be this amount of time. Right? So it's actually pretty simple. We could diagram it, in fact. And I gave you, if you're interested in taking notes on this, I gave you a little diagram of your own that you can keep as sort of a record of this teaching. That comes in handy if you're trying to remember what was said, and also maybe you'll want to, you know, turn someone else onto this at some point. That would be helpful to have the facts all down there where you can get at it. So from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, remember Jerusalem is in ruins as he reads this, until the Messiah the Prince, will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. All right? So it's pretty simple. Now, we can do the math pretty easily. 7 times 7 is 49 years. That's probably the period for the actual rebuilding of the city itself. Probably took 49 years. The 62 times 7 would be 434 years. So we'd add those two together, and we realize this is saying that this time unit is basically 483 years. Now, before we move ahead, though, I would argue that we need to make a conversion because their years, their Hebrew years, were different than our years. Lunar years, they were roughly lunar years, were made up of 12 months of 30 days each. That makes 360 days in a year. Our years are 365 days. So, since we're going to be going by our calendar, not by theirs, we need to convert their time period into our time period. These 360-day years, if there's 483 of them, that's talking about 173,880 days. And converting that roughly to ours, it's actually, we're off by a quarter of a day here because of leap year, but we'll just stick in round numbers. Divide by 365, and then we realize this is 476 of our solar years. They didn't know how long a year was back then. I hadn't figured that part out. And so, that's our number, 476 solar years. And so he's saying, from the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah will be 476 years. Now, all we have to do then, if we could just date this decree to rebuild Jerusalem, hey, then it'd just be a matter of simple math, wouldn't it? So happens there is such a decree, and we can date it. Yeah. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1 through 8. Nehemiah was a dude living in the Persian Empire after Daniel's time. His job was as a wine taster for the king. So, pretty good job. Sit around and drink wine all day. On the other hand, it's a little hard to get life insurance because the reason they had wine tasters is that before the king would ever drink wine, they'd have the wine taster drink it first to see if somebody poisoned it. They were always poisoning each other. And so there was a certain risk factor in this job. And it's actually kind of funny that the king named Artaxerxes, this is a later king in the Persian Empire, says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought to him, the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad?" Right? And he's sitting there saying, "You don't look too healthy, man. Is that nothing wrong with the wine, is there?" You can imagine the king taking an interest in the well-being of his wine taster. Well, Nehemiah says, "Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins? Its gates have been destroyed by fire." And so he opens up and just says, "I feel so sad that my country is still lying over in ruins over there, including Jerusalem with its walls burned, gates burned, its walls torn down." The king says, "Well, what is it you want?" And Nehemiah says, "Well, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governor of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And please send me a letter also to Asaph, the manager of the king's forest, instructing him to give me lumber. I'll need that to make beams for the gates of the temple fortress and for the city walls and for a house for myself." And we read, the king granted these requests. Now, this then is really a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, right? There had been an earlier decree to rebuild the temple, but not the city. Rebuilding the city, especially the walls of the city, was a very significant act when you think about it. Because if you're like an emperor and you've torn down the walls, that's a defensive structure, right? It makes it much harder to take a city if it's a walled city. So to let people rebuild their walls was always running the risk they might decide, "All right, our walls are up, you know, get lost, we're taken over." And then he would have to go and besiege the city, and it'd be a big mess. So there's a lot of trust involved in letting Nehemiah lead this party back to rebuild the walls of the city. And the date on this is in the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now, here's an important thing to get to grasp here. And if you're not familiar with ancient history, you might jump the tracks here at this point and say, now, why? Okay, well, wait a minute. First of all, you're dating this decree by reading the Bible, and then that's supposed to validate the Bible. So you have the Bible validating the Bible. That's arguing in a circle, right? Not true. As a matter of fact, this date and this king, the fact that this happened when it says in Nehemiah is not disputed even by scholars who don't believe a word of the Bible in terms of its spiritual content. This is so well attested. Artaxerxes I started his reign in 465 BC. Here's a photocopy of a page from the Encyclopedia Britannica. I think that's a standard source. Do we all agree? Volume 1, page 598, Artaxerxes I. The Achaemenid king of Persia reigned 465 to 425 BC. Well, you can look it up in any source because there is no debate about this. And he goes on to talk about, you know, what Artaxerxes did, including toward the Jews. He pursued a tolerant policy and that he let them return. He's the one that let the Jews return to their land and rebuild their city. Check it out. Wherever you want. Even Wikipedia would say exactly the same thing. That's because this sequence of Persian emperors is very well attested historically, and the dates are rock solid. There is no debate on any of this. And so, when Nehemiah says that the specific date, you can also, Plutarch has a big article on it. That's the best ancient historical source for information on Artaxerxes I. So, the 20th year of his reign, remembering that numbers go down in B.C. period instead of up, takes us to 445 B.C. for the date of this decree. And I would argue to you that we need to take one more year off because chronological studies indicate that the regnal year, the reigning year of the king by which things were dated in the ancient world in the Persian Empire, began in the month of Tishri. That's in the fall. But the encounter that Nehemiah describes is in the month of Nisan. That's in like April, March, April. So if the 20th year began in fall of 445 and ran till the fall of 444, we're actually in 444 by the time the month of Nisan comes around. And so we have a date for this decree issued right there, 444 BC. Oh, yeah. Oh, and this is where it starts getting real interesting because you can probably sense where this is headed already. 444 BC, 476 years after that, the Messiah will come. Well, let's do the math. Let's use a minus 444 to represent a BC date. We'll add 476 years to that, and it gives us the year positive 32, i.e. 32 AD. And it's really a year later than that, because of the fact that there is no zero year. This is the difference between number lines and calendars. Remember number lines from junior high math? This is a number line superimposed with a calendar. You notice on the left, the BC dates all match, 3, 2, and 1. But the day that 1 BC ended, 1 AD began. And therefore, these numbers don't match, right? They're off by a year. That's why in studying chronology, if you're subtracting across the zero year, you have to add another year. If you're adding, you have to delete a year, whichever way it goes. There is no zero year. And so the actual solution for this problem comes out to 33 AD. And that is the prediction given to Daniel in 539 BC that the Messiah will come in the year 33 AD. Oh my God. And so we have, and that is in fact the best date for Jesus' entry into Jerusalem and his crucifixion there. This was the year in which Jesus died for the sins of humanity. and made it possible for people to form a relationship with God based purely on the gift of God's grace and not at all anymore on how good you are as a person. It's the most important year in the history of the world. The year God opened the doors to eternal life for anyone who wants to take it. Boy, I remember studying this. I was a young believer. I think I mentioned last week, I just started to kind of shiver when I saw this for the first time, because I was a very skeptical young guy. You know, I had problems with the Bible, even though I had become a Christian already. I'd read, you know, supernatural accounts in the Bible and just be like, oh, man, I've never seen anything like that. I don't know, man. Why would I have to believe in this? And I just was never sure how much confidence I could put in the Bible. I'd never seen anything like this before. And I went to this lecture, and the guy was basically explaining this just like I am to you. And I sat there, and I started to realize, dude, okay, Jesus Christ, the most important man in the history of the world, according to the History Channel. Okay? Hardly a Christian source. And they argue that of all the people that have ever lived in the history of the human race, the most important and most influential character that has ever lived is Jesus of Nazareth. Kind of hard to argue with in a lot of ways when you look at the major scope. I mean, there may be a couple other candidates, but he's got to be right there. Around number one. And how writing this early, oh man, I mean, my mind started to race. There's got to be, I'll bet there's another explanation. There must be some explanation for this. And I thought to myself, either this passage is accurately predicting the date of the coming of Christ over 500 years before the fact, or there's some sleight of hand that I don't get here. I followed the argument about the 77s. I knew about the Persian Empire, and I knew that those kings were, you know, known to history. I was already, you know, in college as a history major at the time. So that part I knew about, and, you know, the math seemed pretty simple. Wasn't so sure about that conversion part, but even without it, you know, you were right there. How could this happen? I thought to myself, what if Christians came in and inserted this passage into the book of Daniel after the life of Christ, making the numbers work out so then, you know, basically they faked it. What about that? Well, I learned that that's just simply not possible. It's not possible at all. You know, I mentioned that some scholars try to late date the book of Daniel, which is true, but not that late. I mean, this one is unassailable, because the latest that anyone dates the book of Daniel is 160 BC. And we have seven scrolls and fragments of seven different copies of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls, reliably dated to 100 BC or older. Daniel is in the Septuagint, which was translation of the Old Testament made in 150 BC. Nobody who knows anything about this era of history and the literature involved would suggest that Daniel could have possibly been later than the time of Christ. Of course, the New Testament quotes Daniel often as scripture. They believed it was scripture and from ancient times. No, that's just not possible. This could not have been inserted. Not possible. Well, I thought to myself, are we sure about that date for the decree? I went and did the research. I looked it up and found exactly what I showed you. And, you know, the thing is, you can't really go to different sources and get different dates. They're all the same. And, you know, when that happens, you got to figure they must know what they're talking about. They, you know, those dates are solid, man. So that end isn't going to move. Well, what about this? This one occurred to me a couple hours after I got out of that lecture. I was sitting at home thinking about it, and I thought, oh, I hadn't thought about this. Those guys had seen this passage, okay? They knew that it, you know, predicts the coming of Messiah. They want their man, Jesus, to be recognized as the Messiah. So they're like, we got to make this go down like this year, you know, because this is the year that's predicted for it. And so, you know, I felt kind of crestfallen about that. It disappointed me. Because, you know, that's all my skeptical side needed. It was one possible excuse to discount this. And so I became interested in that question. Would that even be a possibility? I went to a couple of learned people I knew and asked them about it, and they were sending me to some sources. They were saying, I don't think that is possible. And it turns out they were right. Here's why. The New Testament never says anywhere Jesus died in 33 A.D. Okay, they don't even have A.D. and B.C. Neither does it give a specific date for any other way. They had a way to date things. Their way to date things was usually by reference to the years of the ruling monarch, which in this case, in Christ's time, was the Roman emperor. And so they could date things that way. But no date is given for the date of the death of Christ. So why do we say that it was in 33? Well, actually, there's a number of factors that have to be woven together into a matrix of chronological notes in the text. You know, for instance, we know that Jesus was born under Herod the Great, who died in 4 BC. We know that it says in Luke that when he was born, Quirinius was governor of Syria. Well, we can place him in the East in that period from 6 to 3 BC. It says there was a census of the people given by Augustus Caesar. We can determine that that had to have happened around that time too. So the birth of Christ. Then Luke says Jesus was about 32 years of age when he began his ministry. Not when he died, when he began his ministry. Which we have in the first year of Jesus' ministry, he said, tear down this temple and in 3 days I'll build it up. And they said, we've been building this temple for 46 years and you're going to build it up in 3 days. Well, okay, so that's very interesting. We know when they started building the temple. And we can date from that point 46 years later. He says that John the Baptist began his ministry in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius. So that is dated. And we can date that. And then we know that Christ started his ministry shortly thereafter. We know that Jesus was crucified by Pontius Pilate, and we know the years of his rulership in Palestine, from 26 to 36 A.D. And so on it goes. There's at least 20 of these factors that students of this weave together, and basically it narrows and eliminates all possibilities until we get down to 2 possibilities for the date of the death of Christ, 30 A.D. and 33 A.D. Those are the only 2 possibilities. Today, most scholarship favors 33 A.D. as the best date because of a relatively complicated matter having to do with Roman politics. There was this guy named Sejanus that got caught up in a revolution, and the emperor at the time, named Tiberius, found out about it, came in and slaughtered Sejanus, and began to systematically kill all of the cronies that Sejanus had been systematically putting into office in various governmental positions in preparation for his coup to take over the empire. 4,000 officials were killed during this purge over the next 4 years. One of the people that came to power under Sejanus, Pontius Pilate, he was appointed by Sejanus to hold that role. Now, that explains an interesting little quandary we notice in the Gospels, which is where where Pilate has Jesus under arrest and he doesn't want to put him to death. And the people are crying out, crucify, crucify. And he's like, I don't see any guilt in him. He hasn't done anything wrong. And they said, if you don't crucify this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. Because he claimed to be a king. And no friend of Caesar's would tolerate that. Okay? The weird thing is, all of a sudden, Pilate, who we know from history as this brutal, anti-Semitic, iron-fisted ruler, suddenly cowers in front of this crowd and says, well, okay, and he washes his hands and say, I have nothing to do with it, you take him, and he let them crucify him. That picture of Pilate doesn't fit with the Pilate we know from history at all. That's bothered people. Why was he acting like a big sissy all of a sudden, when before he would mow down a crowd of Jews like this for less provocation than what they did? The reason is because he had been appointed by Sejanus, who by now had been found out in 32 AD. And people were being killed by the thousands all over the empire who had been appointed by this man. When they said, you're no friend of Caesar's if you don't do this, he was scared. He thought they could report this. And he gave Christ up. Only a 33 date would explain this behavior of Pontius Pilate. And there's actually a couple of other lesser arguments, but I think you put it all together, and here's the point I'm making, though. Chronological studies. I'll give you a paper if you're interested. I did a lot of research because I was interested in this. On our website, there's a paper on chronological study of the life of Christ, which goes through all of these different factors and shows how they weave together into a chronological picture and a dating for Christ. That's how people, none of it's original with me. I got all of this from other sources. That's how people date the life of Christ. Now, okay, that's the end of that point. Shift gears with me, all right? Here's the real point. The writers of the New Testament, in order to fake this date of 33, would have to know way back then how we today would do chronological research, putting together dates and facts that they often did not have access to, but we do today through our more extensive research in history. They would have to anticipate, they'll probably put together a matrix like this, so we'll set it up like such and so. If they wanted to fake the date, wouldn't they have just said it was in 33? How come they never said that? And how could they have known how we today, as modern historians, were going to date events in the first century AD? No, this is not possible. That is not credible. It's impossible that they faked this, even if they had wanted to. And what would be the reason? What did they get out of this? Our leader gets to die? So they didn't have a motive to, and they didn't have the ability to either. That's the important point. And so you realize, okay, so this passage was not inserted, cannot have been inserted into Daniel. It cannot be after Christ. It has to have been centuries before. The date of the beginning is rock solid. The math, well, you can get your own calculator out for that. I mean, that's not open to too much argument there. And the date for Christ at 33 could not have been faked, even if there was some reason to. Well, what are you left with? You're left with something pretty remarkable here. Now think about this. Even without ever opening the New Testament, if it didn't exist, we would still know that this prophecy is basically true. You know, we couldn't get it to the year like we can with the use of the gospel records. But even just based, for instance, on the Roman historian Tacitus, writing in 100 AD, a little after, who is one of the main historians of this period, writing about the burning of Rome, the fire in Rome, and how Nero, the Roman emperor at the time, this is in the 60s AD, blamed the fire on the Christians. And this is what he says about it. Consequently, to get rid of the report that Nero had started the fire himself, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, that's a reference to crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus, and a most mischievous superstition thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, but the source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. You can sense that Tacitus is not a Christian at all. In fact, he believed that Christians deserved to die, but not as cruelly as Nero tortured them. And he says he was so gross in his tortures of the Christians. This is not the whole section of 44. But he goes on to explain that he was so savage and barbaric in the way he tortured these people to death that the populace felt more sympathy for Christianity. They felt sorry for them. And so that one of his criticisms of Nero is that he actually made Christianity more popular than it was before. And so without even looking at the New Testament, we realize this proposition, that this passage accurately predicts the date of the coming of Jesus, the most influential man in the world, according to the History Channel, over 500 years before he came. Now, how did they do that? What does that mean? How do you explain this here? There, well, that's a good question right there. I like to ask people. I've sat down before with friends who were not Christians and did not believe the Bible. I sat down with one couple. They said to me, I asked them, I was teaching a Bible study, and their son was going to it. And they were suspicious. So they showed up afterwards and wanted to talk to me. I said, well, what are you teaching here? And I said, well, I'm teaching the Bible, because I believe it's true and stuff. I said, how about you? The dude who was a lawyer was like, there's really no evidence for the Bible. I think it's all right and stuff, I guess. But no, I don't think there's evidence that's true or anything from God or anything like that. And I was like, so if you saw evidence that was solid, compelling, and irrefutable, would you change your mind on that? He's sort of like, yeah. And I was like, so, his wife's sitting there going, yeah. I was like, well, if you ever want to take 20 minutes, I said, I'll show you something. I'll show you exactly that. And they're like, well, yeah, listen to that. When? I was like, how about right now? I'm like, yeah. So they lived up the street from this house. We walked up to their house. We got out on the living room floor. I spread out the Bible and got some paper there, and I stepped them through, and they were reading it with me, and I came to this place, and I was like, what do you think about that? And it was very interesting. There was just this silence. They had this grandfather clock that was just. And the dude finally spoke up and he says, I have never seen anything like that before. I had no idea there was something like that in the Bible. And they were fascinated. I said, actually, this is just one. There are several hundred of these in the Bible. I said, this is my favorite. But I said, the others are quite good too. And they're like, well, we want to study this. We want to learn about this. And we've got some friends that want to learn about it too. And I was like, well, why don't you get your friends together and let's set up a night and we'll come over and talk about it. And so they were like, yes, definitely. I showed up. I think we set it up for a week or two after that. I showed up there and walked into this room. There's like 35 people sitting there. I don't know how they got that many people to come out. They must have been, they were up in some liberal church that didn't believe the Bible, and I think they must have just told the whole group up there, you got to hear this. And so I just started to teach some of this stuff there. And in fact, they made me teach this verse. They said, well, you got to go over this part for them. So I did that first week. I was there till 1 a.m, people coming up and out. Man, you know, what about this? What about that? And is it true such and so on? Most of those people became believers in Christ. Yeah. How do you explain something like this? There has to be an explanation, doesn't there? You don't think it's accidental? Surely it's, this wouldn't be an accident. To the year? Give me a break. 539 years away and you're nailing the death of Christ to the year? It's not an accident. It wasn't done afterwards. You can't do that. It's not possible to do it. This passage must come from God. That's something only an omniscient being could do that. You'd have to be omniscient. You'd have to be eternal. You'd have to be able to get outside of time and know the future somehow before you could do something like that. Nobody could do this. And here's another question that comes right along with it, right on the heels of this question. Who is Jesus Christ? This whole prediction is pointing to a single individual, Jesus Christ. Now, who does that make him? You know, there's been lots of religious leaders and messiahs, prophets, men of God saying, I know the way and stuff like that. None of them have something like this behind them. Here's an interesting comment made by Jesus to his followers. After his death and resurrection, they were dumbfounded. And he said, when I was with you before, I told you that everything written about me in Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must all come true. These were the books written centuries before Christ. And he says, they're all predicting me. I'm the one that it's all about. And I told you, everything in there has to come true. And then he sat down and had a Bible study with them and opened up the scrolls. And they were looking at this passage. And they were looking at Isaiah 53, which completely details torture, his death, his resurrection, and the fact that his death was to pay for human sin. Everything. I mean, it's all right there. And Jesus is like, everything written about me has to come true. And so what we have is an ingenious system of validation here. There are many voices claiming to be a Christ figure. Didn't David Koresh say he was Christ? He did. Doesn't Sung Myung Moon say he's Christ? Yes. Are they? No, they're not. Jesus said, many false Christs will come. Jesus was well aware, and God is well aware, that there are many voices calling out in our world saying, hey, this is the truth. No, this is the truth. And it gets to the point where you just feel like, well, you know, I mean, there's so many versions and so many views and stuff. How would you ever know? It's like you really can't know. Nobody knows. And so you're just tempted to just sort of give up. That's very big in our age today. Who really knows? And God knows that. And he wants you to know. That's why he wrote this stuff down, is because he doesn't want us to just like hope that this is true. He wants us to know that it's true. And that when we open up our Bible and see something like this that defies explanation, that we can also look at the other things it says, like that the death of Christ didn't just happen, that it also paid the penalty for human sin and opened the doors for us to have a relationship with God. That part, which we cannot check on, we can't do the math on that part, but it's part from the same source. And so we start to realize the other things that it says there must be from God too. And must be. And I think it's beautiful that God cares about us enough not only to call on us, I want you to trust me, but also he's saying, and I'm not going to ask you to believe this as a blind faith, as just, you know, just don't ask questions, just believe it because the preacher says so, your priest says so, not with God. God says, I want you to believe it, and I'm going to give you evidence for why you should believe it. I am God, and I will tell you the future course of history. That passage we started with in Isaiah, he says, these others are not God. I am God, and I can prove it. And
And that's what you have right in front of you in this passage. When Jesus was here, he was teaching to some people who were pretty skeptical about what he said. And he said, my teaching is not my own. I didn't make this up, all right? But it comes from him who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he'll find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. Here's the key. According to Jesus, if we're sitting and looking at his teaching and wondering, is this real? Is this really God's word here? Should I believe it? He says, if you will tell God that you're willing to do his will, that you're willing to follow him, he will show you that what I'm saying is not made up, and then in fact it comes from him. He'll do that for you. This is a pretty powerful promise. This is basically saying, you know, what God gives us here is a base, a platform from which it's reasonable to take a next step. And the next step is to take our search to God himself. To basically say, God, okay, Daniel 9 just blew my mind. I don't know how that could be there, and I'm thinking it might be you. And it has something to do with Jesus Christ. And if he is real, I need to know that. And you can tell God that. And according to this, according to Jesus, he will answer. And he will give you the rest of the story. You'll have an encounter with God, a personal encounter with God. And then these evidences we have in the Bible begin to combine with your own experience. You know, it's like, okay, I walk into my kitchen. I'm thinking to myself, where I put the peanut butter, all right? Here's all of these cupboards. It's got to be in one of these cupboards. Let's see, it wouldn't be under the sink. I never put it there. I don't think it would be in with the glasses or the dishes. It's probably in that one right there. That's where I usually keep that kind of stuff, all right? Now, you don't know that it's there. You're not certain that it's there. But you've got a pretty good reason, just based on history and whatnot, to think it's probably there. How much evidence does it really take to get to the point where you go over and say, well, why don't we open the door and see if it's there? You open the door, there's the peanut butter. Now you got something else to work on, okay? You have your own personal experience telling you that's the peanut butter and that's where it is. So this is really analogous to what God's putting to us here, what Jesus is putting to us. He's like, you have evidence that shows you this is probably the cupboard, but are you willing to go over and open the door or not? That question right there. Now, I gave you a story of sharing Daniel 9 with that couple. And they were totally willing. Boy, they were so excited to learn that they could know God. They had never imagined that that was even possible or that the Bible could be believed. But I've done it a number of other times and got a completely different reaction. Completely different. I was talking to a friend of mine, Slim, and we were studying this passage last week, and he said he had shared it with a friend of his. And when they got down to the end of it, the dude said, well, I don't believe that Artaxerxes guy existed. And Slim's like, what? Let's go get some books. I mean, what does it take? And, you know, it didn't matter how much evidence was amassed. The guy was just like, I just don't think that's real. I don't think that happened. In other words, a refusal to face the plain facts in front of him. I've shown this to people before and had them say, you know, that's very interesting. I'm going to have to think about that. You know, well, what are you going to think about it? Are you going to connect the dots here and see where this leads? And I've had them get angry. They're like, you know, look, I'll think about it, all right? And it's like, you know, what they're saying is, frankly, I don't care if this is the Word of God because I'm not going to get involved, all right, in that. In other words, they flunk this test. Here's why God leaves it the way he does, is that there needs to be a component of human willingness. And if that's not there, no amount of evidence is going to make any difference. He gives us the evidence. It matters. It's important. But then we're expected to do something with that. And namely, this. Ask God to give you the rest of the evidence. Open up the cupboard door and see if that peanut butter's there. And that means you come to God in your heart. It's quiet. You don't have to tell it, you know, come up and bow at the altar. just in your heart, because God knows your thoughts, say to God, I need to know about this. And if this is real, and if I can have you in my life, I want that. And you're willing. And if you tell God that, He will change your life. You need to continue to listen. Continue to listen, because He'll speak through His Word a lot. You know, that's all important. You'll start having these, it's going to be different for each person, but God will come and meet you. And you can have a relationship with Christ at that point. Daniel chapter 9. Boy, is that interesting. Let's keep reading, all right? Remember, we used 7 sevens and 62 sevens. That's only 69. The prophecy was for 70. We're missing a week. We're missing 1 7. And that's explained in the last part. Okay, so after the 62 weeks, notice in 7 weeks and 62 weeks that Messiah comes. Then after that, afterwards, and it would be the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. This expression, to be cut off out of the land of the living, pretty much everyone agrees, refers to death. To be cut off is to die. Then the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Not that it's the prince himself, but rather the people of the prince who is to come. What we'll learn is that there are actually two people being predicted here. Messiah, the prince, and the prince who is to come. They're different people. The Messiah, the prince, dies right here. Soon, we'll see later, the prince who is to come. And he's an evil worker, a different person. And this group here, who destroyed the city and the sanctuary, were the people of this prince. And so this was fulfilled in 70 AD by the Romans, when the city and the sanctuary, would be the temple, were torn down. We've talked about that before. Its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. Now that's a kind of a vague statement there, don't you think? But it sounds like it's definitely referring, I think, to a passage of time, you know? Even to the end, there will be war and desolations are determined. It sounds like we're sort of hitting fast forward there. Well, he goes on in verse 27. He will confirm a covenant with the many for 1 7. Who is he referring to? You know your grammar, the nearest antecedent, not the Messiah, but rather the prince who is to come, right? The people of the prince who is to come destroy the city. He will confirm a covenant with the many. This is referring to the prince who is to come. The many, undoubtedly referring to the Jewish people. For 1 7, hey, there's our missing week, right? Our missing 7. It says, in the middle of the 7, he will put an end to sacrifice an offering, and on the wing of the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is pointed out, poured out on him. Oh, a couple of interesting things about this passage to think about. First of all, okay, so we've got another 7 years. What is half of 7? 3.5 years. Hey, that's come up before in this book, hasn't it? Time, times, and half a time, the 42 months, the 1260 days, they were all 3.5 years. So that number's coming up here. He will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Oh, so that sense that we were hitting fast forward must be true, because the last thing that happened in 25 is that the temple and the sanctuary, 26, the sanctuary and the temple were destroyed. But now, he's putting an end to sacrifice and offering. If you're Jewish, you cannot have sacrifice any place but one. There's only one place you can do sacrifice and offerings, and that is in the temple. But the temple was destroyed earlier. So what we realize is that in this verse, it's been rebuilt. It's back. There must have been a huge passage of time here. Yeah, how can the offerings and sacrifice exist when the temple just got destroyed? Ah, it's another case of a prophetic gap. that expression, even to the end, the wars and destructions are determined and so forth, is the moving ahead over the gap. And then we start with our narrative again in the last 7 years of human history. It's the same period we've seen that come up in each of Daniel's visions. He will set up an abomination that causes desolation. Well, we know that one from last week, don't we? The abomination of desolation, referred to by Jesus, for instance, when he says, when a lawless one commits the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, Daniel, then run for the hills, because that's when a great tribulation will come on the earth that could destroy everyone on the earth. Yeah, this is set in the last days here, the abomination of desolation. And so until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. And of course, as each of the prophecies says predicted, the beast, the Antichrist, that's who the prince who is to come is. That's why his people are the Roman people. The people of the prince who is to come destroy the city. And then the prince himself finally comes. It's the Antichrist. And this accounts for a number of things. When it says the destruction, the ends decreed upon him, poured out on him, we saw in each one of them that it's during his reign that King Messiah comes and takes over the world and destroys the Antichrist, right? And so this is another reference to that. This is the end of history. And we have skipped from the first coming of Christ to the second coming of Christ, just like all these gaps seem to do. So the 70th week of Daniel, part of the time allocated to your people, so it's a Jewish period. That's interesting, because the book of Revelations talks about this period, and it's always talking about the Jews, never the church. It's always the 12 tribes of Israel. Check it out. The church kind of disappears after the third chapter in Revelation, and after that, it's all the tribes of Israel. And they're into all this Old Testament-style stuff with the temple and all that kind of stuff. And this explains that, because he said 70 weeks are given to your people to finish their work. This is predominantly, spiritual action is centering in the Jewish people during this period. It's associated with the beast and the abomination of desolation. It's divided in half into 3.5-year periods. And that probably accounts for the two descriptions of the tribulation we see in Scripture, where sometimes it's described as a time of world peace and unity, where the whole world follows after the beast. And sometimes then it's described as a period of war, culminating in Armageddon and the near destruction of humanity. And these then are the two halves of this tribulation period. It's 3.5 years and 3.5 years. And there you have an explanation for the end of the prediction, just in case somebody asked. So there are two things predicted here: the coming of Christ and his death, and the coming of the Antichrist near the end of history.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.